that proves very effective when there are lots of local maxima in the problem. For example, computer scientists use this approach when trying to decipher codes. Since there are lots of ways to begin decrypting a message that look promising at first, but end up being dead ends. In decryption, having a text that looks somewhat close to sensible English doesn't necessarily mean that you're even on the right track. So sometimes it's best not to get too attached to an initial direction that shows promise and simply start over from scratch. But there's also a third approach. Instead of turning to full-bore randomness when you're stuck, use a little bit of randomness every time you make a decision. This technique, developed by the same Los Alamos team that came up with the Monte Carlo method, is called the Metropolis algorithm. The Metropolis algorithm is like hill climbing, trying out different small-scale tweaks on a solution, but with one important difference. At any given point, it will potentially accept bad tweaks as well as good ones. We can imagine applying this to our vacation planning problem. Again, we try to tweak our proposed solution by jiggling around the positions of different cities. If a randomly generated tweak to our travel route results in an improvement, then we always accept it and continue tweaking from there. But if the alteration would make things a little worse, there's still a chance we go with it anyway. Although the worse the alteration is, the smaller the chance. That way, we won't get stuck in any local maximum for very long. Eventually, we'll try another nearby solution, even though it's more expensive, and potentially be on our way to coming up with a new and better plan. Whether it's a jitter, random restarts, or being open to occasional worsening, randomness is incredibly useful for avoiding local maxima. Chance is not just a viable way of dealing with tough optimization problems. In many cases, it's essential. Some questions linger, however. How much randomness should you use? And when? And, given that strategies such as the Metropolis algorithm can permute our itinerary pretty much ad infinitum, how do you ever know that you're done? For researchers working on optimization, a surprisingly definitive answer to these questions would come from another field entirely. Simulated annealing. In the late 1970s and early 80s, Scott Kirkpatrick considered himself a physicist, not a computer scientist. In particular, Kirkpatrick was interested in statistical physics, which uses randomness as a way to explain certain natural phenomena. For instance, the physics of annealing, the way that materials change state as they are heated and cooled. Perhaps the most interesting characteristic of annealing is that how quickly or slowly a material is cooled tends to have tremendous impact on its final structure. As Kirkpatrick explains, growing a single crystal from a melt is done by careful annealing, first melting the substance, then lowering the temperature slowly, and spending a long time at temperatures in the vicinity of the freezing point. If this is not done and the substance is allowed to get out of equilibrium, the resulting crystal will have many defects, or the substance may form a glass with no crystalline order. Kirkpatrick was then working at IBM, where one of the biggest, trickiest, and most hallowed problems was how to lay out the circuits on the chips that IBM was manufacturing. The problem was ungainly and intractable. There was an enormous range of possible solutions to consider, and some tricky constraints. It was better in general for the components to be close together, for instance, but not too close or there would be no room for the wires. And any time you moved anything, you'd have to recompute how all the wires would run in the new hypothetical layout. At the time, this process was led by something of a cryptic guru-type figure within IBM. As Kirkpatrick recalls, the guy who was the best at IBM at squeezing more circuits on a chip, he had the most mysterious way of explaining what he was doing. He didn't like to really tell you. Kirkpatrick's friend and IBM colleague, Dan Gillat, was fascinated by the problem and quickly hooked Kirkpatrick, who had a flash of insight. The way to study physical systems was to warm them up, then cool them down, and let the system organize itself. From that background, it seemed like a perfectly natural thing to treat all kinds of optimization problems as if the degrees of freedom that you were trying to organize were little atoms or spins or what have you. In physics, what we call temperature is really velocity, random motion at the molecular scale. This was directly analogous, Kirkpatrick reasoned, to the random jitter that can be added to a hill climbing algorithm to make it sometimes backtrack from better solutions to worse ones. In fact, the Metropolis algorithm itself had initially been designed to model random behavior in physical systems, in that case, nuclear explosions. So what would happen, Kirkpatrick wondered, if you treated an optimization problem like an annealing problem, if you heated it up and then slowly cooled it off? Taking the 10-city vacation problem from earlier, we could start at a high temperature by picking our starting itinerary entirely at random, plucking one out of the whole space of possible solutions, regardless of price. Then we can start to slowly cool down our search by rolling a die whenever we are considering a tweak to the city sequence. Taking a superior variation always makes sense, but we would only take inferior ones when the die shows, say, a 2 or more. After a while, we'd cool it further by only taking a higher price change if the die shows a 3 or greater, then 4, then 5. Eventually, we'd be mostly hill climbing, making the inferior move just occasionally when the die shows a 6. Finally, we'd start going only uphill and stop when we reach the next local max. This approach, called simulated annealing, seemed like an intriguing way to map physics onto problem solving. But would it work? The initial reaction among more traditional optimization researchers was that this whole approach just seemed a little too metaphorical. I couldn't convince math people that this messy stuff with temperatures, all this analogy-based stuff, was real, says Kirkpatrick, because mathematicians are trained to really distrust intuition. But any distrust regarding the analogy-based approach would soon vanish. At IBM, Kirkpatrick and Gillette's simulated annealing algorithms started making better chip layouts than the guru. Rather than keep mum about their secret weapon and become cryptic guru figures themselves, they published their method in a paper in Science, opening it up to others. Over the next few decades, that paper would be cited a whopping 32,000 times. To this day, simulated annealing remains one of the most promising approaches to optimization problems known to the field. Randomness, evolution, and creativity. In 1943, Salvador Luria didn't know he was about to make a discovery that would lead to a Nobel Prize. He thought he was going to a dance. A recent immigrant to the United States from Mussolini's Italy, where his Sephardic Jewish family had lived, Luria was a researcher studying how bacteria developed immunity from viruses. But at this moment, his research was far from his mind, as he attended a faculty gathering at a country club near Indiana University. Luria was watching one of his colleagues play a slot machine. Not a gambler myself, I was teasing him about his inevitable losses, when he suddenly hit the jackpot, about $3 in dimes, gave me a dirty look, and walked away. Right then I began giving some thought to the actual numerology of slot machines. In doing so, it dawned on me that slot machines and bacterial mutations have something to teach each other. In the 1940s, it wasn't known exactly why or how bacterial resistance to viruses, and for that matter to antibiotics, came about. Were they reactions within the bacteria to the virus? Or were there simply ongoing mutations that occasionally produced resistance by accident? There seemed no way to devise an experiment that would offer a decisive answer one way or the other. That is, until Luria saw that slot machine and something clicked. Luria realized that if he bred several generations of different lineages of bacteria, then exposed the last generation to a virus, one of two radically different things would happen. If resistance was a response to the virus, he'd expect roughly the same amount of resistant bacteria to appear in every one of his bacterial cultures, regardless of their lineage. On the other hand, if resistance emerged from chance mutations, he'd expect to see something a lot more uneven, just like a slot machine's payouts. That is, bacteria from most lineages would show no resistance at all. Some lineages would have a single grandchild culture that had mutated to become resistant. And on rare occasions, if the proper mutation had happened several generations up the family tree, there would be a jackpot. All the grandchildren in the lineage would be resistant. Luria left the dance as soon as he could and set the experiment in motion. After several days of tense, restless waiting, Luria returned to the lab to check on his colonies. Jackpot. Luria's discovery was about the power of chance, about how random haphazard mutations can produce viral resistance. But it was also, at least in part, due to the power of chance. He was in the right place at the right time, where seeing the slot machine triggered a new idea. Tales of discovery often feature a similar moment. Newton's possibly apocryphal apple, Archimedes' bathtub eureka, the neglected petri dish that grew penicillium mold. Indeed, it's a common enough phenomenon that a word was invented to capture it. In 1754, Horace Walpole coined the term serendipity, based on the fairy tale adventures of the three princes of Serendip, Serendip being the archaic name of Sri Lanka, who were always making discoveries by accidents and sagacity of things they were not in quest of. This double role of randomness, a key part of biology, a key part of discovery, has repeatedly caught the eye of psychologists who want to explain human creativity. An early instance of this idea was offered by William James. In 1880, having recently been appointed assistant professor of psychology at Harvard and 10 years away from publishing his definitive Principles of Psychology, James wrote an article in the Atlantic Monthly called Great Men, Great Thoughts, and the Environment. The article opens with his thesis. A remarkable parallel, which to my knowledge has never been noticed, obtains between the facts of social evolution and the mental growth of the race on the one hand, and of zoological evolution as expounded by Mr. Darwin on the other. At the time James was writing, the idea of zoological evolution was still fresh. On the Origin of Species having been published in 1859 and Mr. Darwin himself still alive. James discussed how evolutionary ideas might be applied to different aspects of human society, and toward the end of the article turned to the evolution of ideas. New conceptions, emotions, and active tendencies which evolve are originally produced in the shape of random images, fancies, accidental outbursts of spontaneous variation in the functional activity of the excessively unstable human brain, which the outer environment simply confirms or refutes, adopts or rejects, preserves or destroys. Selects, in short, just as it selects morphological and social variations due to molecular accidents of an analogous sort. James thus viewed randomness as the heart of creativity. And he believed it was magnified in the most creative people. In their presence, he wrote, we seem suddenly introduced into a seething cauldron of ideas, where everything is fizzling and bobbing about in a state of bewildering activity, where partnerships can be joined or loosened in an instant, treadmill routine is unknown, and the unexpected seems the only law. Note here the same annealing intuition, rooted in metaphors of temperature, where wild permutation equals heat. The modern instantiation of James' theory appears in the work of Donald Campbell, a psychologist who lived 100 years later. In 1960, Campbell published a paper called Blind Variation and Selective Retention in Creative Thought as in Other Knowledge Processes. Like James, he opened with his central thesis. A blind variation and selective retention process is fundamental to all inductive achievements, to all genuine increases in knowledge, to all increases in fit of system to environment. And like James, he was inspired by evolution, thinking about creative innovation as the outcome of new ideas being generated randomly and astute human minds retaining the best of those ideas. Campbell supported his argument liberally with quotes from other scientists and mathematicians about the processes behind their own discoveries. The 19th century physicists and philosophers Ernst Mach and Henri Poincaré both seemed to offer an account similar to Campbell's, with Mach going so far as to declare that thus are to be explained the statements of Newton, Mozart, Richard Wagner, and others, when they say that thought, melodies, and harmonies had poured in upon them, and that they had simply retained the right ones. When it comes to stimulating creativity, a common technique is introducing a random element, such as a word that people have to form associations with. For example, musician Brian Eno and artist Peter Schmidt created a deck of cards known as oblique strategies for solving creative problems. Pick a card, any card, and you will get a random new perspective on your project. And if that sounds like too much work, you can now download an app that will pick a card for you. Eno's account of why they developed the cards has clear parallels with the idea of escaping local maxima. When you're very in the middle of something, you forget the most obvious things. You come out of the studio and you think, why didn't we remember to do this or that? These cards really are just ways of throwing you out of the frame, of breaking the context a little bit, so that you're not a band in a studio focused on one song, but you're people who are alive and in the world and aware of a lot of other things as well. Being randomly jittered, thrown out of the frame and focused on a larger scale, provides a way to leave what might be locally good and get back to the pursuit of what might be globally optimal. And you don't need to be Brian Eno to add a little random stimulation to your life. Wikipedia, for instance, offers a random article link, and Tom has been using it as his browser's default homepage for several years, seeing a randomly selected Wikipedia entry each time he opens a new window. While this hasn't yet resulted in any striking discoveries, he now knows a lot about some obscure topics, such as the kind of knife used by the Chilean armed forces, and he feels that some of these have enriched his life. For example, he's learned that there is a word in Portuguese for a vague and constant desire for something that does not and probably cannot exist, a problem we still can't solve with a search engine. An interesting side effect is that he now also has a better sense not just of what sorts of topics are covered by Wikipedia, but also of what randomness really looks like. For example, pages that feel like they have some connection to him, articles about people or places he knows, show up with what seems like surprising frequency. In a test, he got members of the Western Australian Legislative Council 1962 to 1965 after just two reloads, and he grew up in Western Australia. Knowing that these are actually randomly generated makes it possible to become better calibrated for evaluating other coincidences in the rest of his life. In the physical world, you can randomize your vegetables by joining a community-supported agriculture farm, which will deliver a box of produce to you every week. As we learned earlier, a CSA subscription does potentially pose a scheduling problem, but being sent fruits and vegetables you wouldn't normally buy is a great way to get knocked out of a local maximum in your recipe rotation. Likewise, book, wine, and chocolate of the month clubs are a great way to get exposed to intellectual, onophilic, and gustatory possibilities that you might never have encountered otherwise. You might worry that making every decision by flipping a coin could lead to trouble, not least with your boss, friends, and family. And it's true that mainlining randomness into your life is not necessarily a recipe for success. The cult classic 1971 novel The Dice Man by Luke Reinhardt, real name George Cockcroft, provides a cautionary tale. Its narrator, a man who replaces decision-making with dice rolling, quickly ends up in situations that most of us would probably like to avoid. But perhaps it's just a case of a little knowledge being a dangerous thing. If the Dice Man had only had a deeper grasp of computer science, he'd have had some guidance. First, from hill climbing, even if you're in the habit of sometimes acting on bad ideas, You should always act on good ones. Second, from the Metropolis algorithm, your likelihood of following a bad idea should be inversely proportional to how bad an idea it is. Third, from simulated annealing, you should front-load randomness, rapidly cooling out of a totally random state, using ever less and less randomness as time goes on, lingering longest as you approach freezing. Temper yourself, literally. This last point wasn't lost on the novel's author. Cockcroft himself apparently turned, not unlike his protagonist, to dicing for a time in his life, living nomadically with his family on a Mediterranean sailboat in a kind of Brownian slow motion. At some point, however, his annealing schedule cooled off. He settled down comfortably into a local maximum on a lake in upstate New York. Now in his 80s, he's still contentedly there. Once you got somewhere you were happy, he told The Guardian, you'd be stupid to shake it up any further. 10. Networking. How we connect. The term connection has a wide variety of meanings. It can refer to a physical or logical path between two entities. It can refer to the flow over the path. It can inferentially refer to an action associated with the setting up of a path, or it can refer to an association between two or more entities with or without regard to any path between them. Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn. Only connect. E.M. Forster. The long-distance telegraph began with a portent. Samuel F.B. Morse, standing in the chambers of the U.S. Supreme Court on May 24th, 1844, wiring his assistant Alfred Vail in Baltimore a verse from the Old Testament. What hath God wrought? The first thing we ask of any new connection is how it began, and from that origin can't help trying to augur its future. The first telephone call in history, made by Alexander Graham Bell to his assistant on March 10th, 1876, began with a bit of a paradox. Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you. A simultaneous testament to its ability and inability to overcome physical distance. The cell phone began with a boast. Motorola's Martin Cooper, walking down 6th Avenue on April 3rd, 1973, as Manhattan pedestrians gawked, calling his rival, Joel Engel at AT&T. Joel, I'm calling you from a cellular phone. A real cellular phone, a handheld, portable, real cellular phone. I don't remember exactly what he said, Cooper recalls, but it was really quiet for a while. My assumption was that he was grinding his teeth. And the text message began on December 3rd, 1992, with cheer. Neil Papworth at SEMA Group Telecoms wishing Vodafone's Richard Jarvis an early Merry Christmas. The beginnings of the Internet were, somehow fittingly, much humbler and more inauspicious than all of that. It was October 29th, 1969, and Charlie Klein at UCLA sent to Bill Duvall at the Stanford Research Institute the first message ever transmitted from one computer to another via the ARPANET. The message was log in, or would have been, had the receiving machine not crashed after lo. Lo. Verily, Klein managed to sound portentous and Old Testament despite himself. The foundation of human connection is protocol, a shared convention of procedures and expectations, from handshakes and hellos to etiquette, politesse, and the full gamut of social norms. Machine connection is no different. Protocol is how we get on the same page. In fact, the word is rooted in the Greek protokolon, first glue, which referred to the outer page attached to a book or manuscript. In interpersonal affairs, these protocols prove a subtle but perennial source of anxiety. I sent so-and-so a message however many days ago. At what point do I begin to suspect they never received it? It's now 12:05 p.m. and our call was set for noon. Are we both expecting each other to be the one calling? Your answer seems odd. Did I mishear you or did you mishear me? Come again? Most of our communication technology, from the telegraph to the text, has merely provided us with new conduits to experience these familiar person-to-person challenges. But with the internet, computers became not only the conduit, but also the endpoints, the ones doing the talking. As such, they've needed to be responsible for solving their own communication issues. These machine-to-machine problems, and their solutions, at once mimic and illuminate our own. Packet switching. What we now think of as the internet is actually a collection of many protocols, but the chief among them, so much so that it's often referred to more or less synonymously with the internet, is what's known as Transmission Control Protocol, or TCP. It was born from a 1973 talk and a 1974 paper by Vinton Vint Cerf and Robert Bob Kahn, who laid out a proposal for the language of, as they imagined calling it, an internetwork. TCP initially used telephone lines, but it's more appropriately regarded as the evolution of the mail rather than the phone. Phone calls use what's called circuit switching. The system opens a channel between the sender and the receiver, which supplies constant bandwidth between the parties in both directions as long as the call lasts. Circuit switching makes plenty of sense for human interaction, but as early as the 1960s, it was clear that this paradigm wasn't going to work for machine communications. As UCLA's Leonard Kleinrock recalls, "I knew that computers, when they talk, they don't talk the way I am now, continuously. They go blast, and they're quiet for a while. A little while later, they suddenly come up and blast again. And you can't afford to dedicate a communications connection to something which is almost never talking, but when it wants to talk, it wants immediate access. So we had to not use the telephone network, which was designed for continuous talking, the circuit switching network, but something else." The telephone companies, for their part, did not seem especially amenable to talk of a fundamental shift in their protocols. Moving away from circuit switching was considered lunatic, utter heresy, in the words of networking researcher Van Jacobsen. Kleinrock reminisces about his own encounters with the telecommunications industry. "I went to AT&T, the biggest network of the time, and I explained to them, 'You guys ought to give us good data communications.' And their answer was, 'What are you talking about? The United States is a copper mine. It's full of telephone wires. Use that.' I said, 'No, no, you don't understand. It takes 35 seconds to set up a call. You charge me a minimum of 3 minutes, and I want to send 100 milliseconds of data.' And their answer was, 'Little boy, go away.' So little boy went away, and, with others, developed this technology which ate their lunch." The technology that ate circuit switching's lunch would become known as packet switching. In a packet-switched network, rather than using a dedicated channel for each connection, senders and receivers atomize their messages into tiny shards known as packets and merge them into the communal flow of data, a bit like postcards moving at the speed of light. In such a network, what you might call a connection is a consensual illusion between the two endpoints, explains Apple networking expert Stuart Cheshire. "There are no connections in the internet. Talking about a connection in the internet is like talking about a connection in the U.S. mail system. You write letters to people and each letter goes independently, and you may have a correspondence that goes back and forth and has some continuity to it, but the U.S. mail doesn't need to know about that. They just deliver the letters." Efficient use of bandwidth wasn't the only consideration driving research into packet switching in the 1960s. The other was nuclear war. Paul Barron at the Rand Corporation was trying to solve the problem of network robustness so that military communications could survive a nuclear attack that took out a sizable fraction of the network. Inspired by algorithms developed in the 1950s for navigating mazes, Barron imagined a design in which every piece of information could independently make its own way to its destination, even as the network was changing dynamically, or being torn to tatters. This was the second demerit against circuit switching and its dedicated, stable connections. That very stability meant that a dropped call stayed dropped. Circuit switching just wasn't flexible or adaptable enough to be robust. And here, too, packet switching could offer just what the times were calling for. In circuit-switched networks, a call fails if any one of its links gets disrupted, which means that reliability goes down exponentially as a network grows larger. In packet switching, on the other hand, the proliferation of paths in a growing network becomes a virtue. There are now that many more ways for data to flow, so the reliability of the network increases exponentially with its size. Still, as Van Jacobsen tells it, even after packet switching was devised, the phone companies were unimpressed. All the telco people said, with very loud voices, "That's not a network. That's just a crummy way to use our network. You're taking our wires, you're sending on the paths that we create, and you're putting a lot of extra gunk on it so that you use it really inefficiently." But from a packet switching point of view, the phone wires are just a means to an end. The sender and receiver don't actually care how the packets get delivered. The ability to operate agnostically over any number of diverse media would be packet switching's great virtue. After early networks in the late 60s and early 70s, such as the ARPANET, proved the viability of the concept, networks of all types began sprouting across the country, doing packet switching not only over copper phone wires, but over satellites and over radio. In 2001, a group of computer scientists in the Norwegian city of Bergen briefly implemented a packet-switching network over avian carriers, that is, packets written down on paper and tied to pigeons' feet. Of course, packet-switching would not be without its own problems. For starters, one of the first questions for any protocol, human or machine, is quite simply, how do you know your messages are getting through? Acknowledgement. No transmission can be 100% reliable. Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn. What hath God wrought wasn't just the first long-distance telegraph message sent in the United States. It was also the second. Alfred Vail sent the quotation back to Morse in the Supreme Court chambers as a way of confirming receipt. Now, Vail's reply could make Morse and the U.S. legislators gathered around him confident that Morse's message had been received, presuming, of course, that Vail hadn't known the choice of message in advance. But what would make Vail confident that his confirmation had been received? Computer scientists know this concept as the Byzantine generals problem. Imagine two generals on opposite sides of a valley that contains their common enemy, attempting to coordinate an attack. Only by perfect synchronization will they succeed, for either to attack alone is suicide. What's worse, any messages from one general to the other must be delivered by hand across the very terrain that contains the enemy, meaning there's a chance that any given message will never arrive. The first general, say, suggests a time for the attack, but won't dare go for it unless he knows for sure that his comrade is moving too. The second general receives the orders and sends back a confirmation, but won't dare attack unless he knows that the first general received that confirmation, since otherwise the first general won't be going. The first general receives the confirmation, but won't attack until he's certain that the second general knows he did. Following this chain of logic requires an infinite series of messages, and obviously that won't do. Communication is one of those delightful things that work only in practice. In theory, it's impossible. In most scenarios, the consequences of communication lapses are rarely so dire, and the need for certainty rarely so absolute. In TCP, a failure generally leads to retransmission rather than death, so it's considered enough for a session to begin with what's called a triple handshake. The visitor says hello. The server acknowledges the hello and says hello back. The visitor acknowledges that, and if the server receives this third message, Then no further confirmation is needed and they're off to the races. Even after this initial connection is made, however, there's still a risk that some later packets may be damaged or lost in transit or arrive out of order. In the postal mail, package delivery can be confirmed via return receipts. Online, packet delivery is confirmed by what are called acknowledgement packets, or ACKs. These are critical to the functioning of the network. The way that ACKs work is both simple and clever. Behind the scenes of the triple handshake, each machine provides the other with a kind of serial number, and it's understood that every packet sent after that will increment those serial numbers by one each time, like checks in a checkbook. For instance, if your computer initiates contact with a web server, it might send that server, say, the number 100. The ACK sent by the server will in turn specify the serial number at which the server's own packets will begin, call it 5000, and will also say, ready for 101. Your machine's ACK will carry the number 101 and will convey in turn, ready for 5001. Note that these two numbering schemes are totally independent and the number that begins each sequence is typically chosen at random. This mechanism offers a ready way to pinpoint when packets have gone astray. If the server is expecting 101 but instead gets 102, it will send an ACK to packet 102 that still says, ready for 101. If it next gets packet 103, it will say again, ready for 101. Three such redundant ACKs in a row would signal to your machine that 101 isn't just delayed, but hopelessly gone, so it will resend that packet. At that point, the server, which has kept packets 102 and 103, will send an ACK saying, ready for 104, to signal that the sequence has been restored. All those acknowledgements can actually add up to a considerable amount of traffic. We think of, say, a large file transfer as a one-way operation, but in fact, the recipient is sending hundreds of control messages back to the sender. A report from the second half of 2014 showed that almost 10% of upstream internet traffic during peak hours was due to Netflix, which we tend to think of as sending data almost exclusively downstream to users. But all that video generates an awful lot of ACKs. In the human sphere, the anxiety that the message is indeed being received similarly pervades conversation. A speaker might subconsciously append, you know, to the end of every sentence, and a listener, for their part, can't help but make a steady stream of nods, yas, aye-ayes, roger that's, ten-fours, uh-huhs. We do this even face-to-face, but on a phone call, sometimes it's the only way to know that the call is even still in progress. No wonder that the most successful 21st century marketing campaign for a wireless carrier featured a network engineer's quality control catchphrase, repeated again and again. Can you hear me now? When something goes wrong in that back and forth, we're often left with a question mark. As software blogger Tyler Treat writes, in a distributed system, we try to guarantee the delivery of a message by waiting for an acknowledgement that it was received. But all sorts of things can go wrong. Did the message get dropped? Did the ACK get dropped? Did the receiver crash? Are they just slow? Is the network slow? Am I slow? The issues faced by the Byzantine generals, as he reminds us, are not design complexities. They are impossibility results. Earlier networking research, Vint Cerf notes, had been founded on the assumption that you could build a reliable underlying net. On the other hand, the internet was based on the assumption that no network was necessarily reliable, and you had to do end-to-end retransmissions to recover. Ironically, one of the few exceptions to this is in transmitting the human voice. Real-time voice communications such as Skype typically do not use TCP, which underlies most of the rest of the internet. As researchers discovered in the early days of networking, using reliable, robust protocols with all their ACKs and retransmission of lost packets to transmit the human voice is overkill. The humans provide the robustness themselves. As Cerf explains, in the case of voice, if you lose a packet, you just say, "Say that again, I missed something." For this reason, phone services that automatically reduce background noise to silence are doing their users a major disservice. Background static is a continual reassurance that the call is still connected and that any silence is a deliberate choice by the other party. Without it, one must constantly confront the possibility that the call has dropped and constantly offer reassurances that it has not. This, too, is the anxiety of all packet switching protocols, indeed of any medium rooted in asynchronous turn-taking, be it letter writing, texting, or the tentative back and forths of online dating. Every message could be the last, and there is often no telling the difference between someone taking their time to respond and someone who has long since ended the conversation. So how exactly should we handle a person, or a computer, that's unreliable? The first question is how long a period of non-responsiveness we should take to constitute a breakdown. Partly this depends on the nature of the network. We start to worry in a matter of seconds over the phone, days over email, and weeks over postal mail. The longer the round-trip time between sender and receiver, the longer it takes a silence to be significant, and the more information can be potentially in flight before the sender realizes there's a problem. In networking, having the parties properly tune their expectations for the timeliness of acknowledgments is crucial to the system functioning correctly. The second question, of course, once we do recognize a breakdown, is what exactly we should do about it. Exponential backoff, the algorithm of forgiveness. The world's most difficult word to translate has been identified as Ilunga from the Shiluba language spoken in southeastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. Ilunga means a person who is ready to forgive any abuse for the first time, to tolerate it a second time, but never a third time. BBC News. If at first you don't succeed, try again. T.H. Palmer. Today we expect our devices to communicate wirelessly, even when wires would be easy. Our keyboard and mouse, for instance, talking wirelessly with a computer sitting inches away. But wireless networking began as a matter of necessity in a place where no wires could do the job, Hawaii. In the late 60s and early 70s, Norman Abramson at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu was trying to link together the university's 7 campuses and many research institutes spread across 4 islands and hundreds of miles. He hit upon the idea of implementing packet switching via radio rather than the phone system, connecting the islands with a loose chain of transmitters and receivers. This system would come to be known as the Aloha Net. The biggest hurdle that the Aloha Net had to overcome was interference. Sometimes 2 stations would transmit at the same moment, inadvertently jamming one another's signals. This is, of course, a familiar feature in human conversation as well. If both stations simply retransmitted right away to try to get their message across, they'd run the risk of getting stuck in perpetual interference forever. Clearly, the Aloha Net protocol was going to need to tell competing signals how to give each other space, how to yield and make way for one another. The first thing that the senders need to do here is what's called breaking symmetry. As any sidewalk pedestrian knows, dodging right as an oncoming walker dodges left, and then having both of you simultaneously dodge back the other way, doesn't solve anything. It's the same story when 2 speakers both pause, make gestures of deference to the other, and then start to speak again at the same time. Or when 2 cars at an intersection, each having stopped to yield to the other, try to accelerate in sync. This is an area where the use of randomness becomes essential. Indeed, networking wouldn't be possible without it. One straightforward solution is to have each station flip a coin. Heads, it retransmits. Tails, it waits a turn, then retransmits. Surely one of them will get through uncontested before long. This works well enough when there are only 2 senders, but what if there are 3 simultaneous signals, or 4? It would take a 1 in 4 chance for the network to get even a single packet through at that point, after which you'd still have three conflicting stations left, and perhaps even more competing signals arriving meanwhile. As the number of conflicts increases further, the network's throughput could simply fall off a cliff. A 1970 report on the AlohaNet said that above a mere 18.6% average utilization of the airwaves, the channel becomes unstable and the average number of retransmissions becomes unbounded. Not good. So what to do? Is there a way to make a system that could avoid this fate? The breakthrough turned out to be increasing the average delay after every successive failure, specifically doubling the potential delay before trying to transmit again. So after an initial failure, a sender would randomly retransmit either one or two turns later. After a second failure, it would try again anywhere from one to four turns later. A third failure in a row would mean waiting somewhere between one and eight turns, and so on. This elegant approach allows the network to accommodate potentially any number of competing signals. Since the maximum delay length, 2, 4, 8, 16, forms an exponential progression, it's become known as exponential backoff. Exponential backoff was a huge part of the successful functioning of the AlohaNet beginning in 1971, and in the 1980s it was baked into TCP, becoming a critical part of the Internet. All these decades later, it still is. As one influential paper puts it, "For a transport endpoint embedded in a network of unknown topology and with an unknown, unknowable, and constantly changing population of competing conversations, only one scheme has any hope of working: exponential backoff." But it is the algorithm's other uses that suggest something both more prescriptive and more profound. Beyond just collision avoidance, exponential backoff has become the default way of handling almost all cases of networking failure or unreliability. For instance, when your computer is trying to reach a website that appears to be down, it uses exponential backoff, trying again 1 second later, again a few seconds after that, and so forth. This is good for everyone. It prevents a host server that's down from getting slammed with requests as soon as it comes back online. And it prevents your own machine from wasting too much effort trying to get blood from a stone. But interestingly, it also does not force or allow your machine to ever completely give up. Exponential backoff is also a critical part of networking security, when successive password failures in logging into an account are punished by an exponentially increasing lockout period. This prevents a hacker from using a dictionary attack against an account, cycling through potential password after password until eventually they get lucky. At the same time, it also solves another problem. The account's real owner, no matter how forgetful, is never permanently locked out after some arbitrary cutoff. In human society, we tend to adopt a policy of giving people some finite number of chances in a row, then giving up entirely. Three strikes, you're out. This pattern prevails by default in almost any situation that requires forgiveness, lenience, or perseverance. Simply put, maybe we're doing it wrong. A friend of ours recently mused about a childhood companion who had a disconcerting habit of flaking on social plans. What to do? Deciding once and for all that she'd finally had enough and giving up entirely on the relationship seemed arbitrary and severe, but continuing to persist in perpetual rescheduling seemed naive, liable to lead to an endless amount of disappointment and wasted time. Solution: exponential backoff on the invitation rate. Try to reschedule in a week, then two, then four, then eight. The rate of retransmission goes toward zero, yet you never have to completely give up. Another friend of ours agonized about whether to offer shelter and financial assistance to a family member with a history of drug addiction. She couldn't bear to give up hope that he would turn things around, and couldn't bear the thought of turning her back on him for good. But she also couldn't bring herself to do all that it required to have him in her house, buying him clothes and cooking for him, reopening bank accounts for him and driving him to work each morning. When at some mysterious and abrupt moment, he would take all the money and disappear, only to call again several weeks later and ask to be forgiven and taken back in. It seemed like a paradox, a cruel and impossible choice. Exponential backoff isn't a magic panacea in cases like this, but it does offer a possible way forward. Requiring an exponentially increasing period of sobriety, for instance, would offer a disincentive to violate the house rules again. It would make the family member prove, ever more assiduously, that he was serious about returning, and would protect the host from the otherwise continuous stress of the cycle. Perhaps most importantly, the host would never have to tell her relative that she'd given up on him for good, or that he was beyond redemption. It offers a way to have finite patience and infinite mercy. Maybe we don't have to choose. In fact, the past decade has seen the beginnings of a quiet revolution in the way the justice system itself handles community supervision for drug offenders. That revolution is being spearheaded by a pilot program called HOPE, which uses the exponential backoff principles of the Aloha Net, and which, in a striking coincidence, began at the birthplace of the Aloha Net itself, Honolulu. Shortly after being sworn in to Hawaii's First Circuit Court, Judge Stephen Alm noticed a remarkable pattern. Probationers would repeatedly violate their probation terms, and circuit judges would routinely use their discretion to let them off with a warning. But at some point, perhaps after a dozen or more violations, the judge would decide to be strict and assign the violator a prison sentence measured in years. Says Alm, "I thought, what a crazy way to try to change anybody's behavior." So Alm proposed almost exactly the opposite. In place of violation hearings scheduled a long time into the future, requiring uncertain judgment calls and occasionally producing huge penalties, HOPE is based on immediate, predefined punishments that begin with just one day in jail and increase after each incident. A 5-year study by the Department of Justice reported that HOPE probationers were half as likely as regular probationers to be arrested for a new crime or have their probation revoked, and they were 72% less likely to use drugs. 17 states have followed Hawaii's lead and launched their own versions of HOPE. Flow control and congestion avoidance. The first efforts at computer networking focused on establishing reliable transmissions over unreliable links. These efforts proved to be so successful that a second concern immediately arose, making sure that an overloaded network could avoid catastrophic meltdown. No sooner had TCP solved the problem of getting data from point A to point B than it was confronted with the problem of gridlock. The most significant early warning came in 1986 on a line connecting the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory and the UC Berkeley campus, which are separated by about the length of a football field. At Berkeley, the space happens to be filled with an actual football field. One day, the bandwidth of that line dropped abruptly from its typical 32,000 bits per second to just 40 bits per second. The victims, Van Jacobsen at LBL and Michael Carrolls at UCB, were fascinated by this sudden factor of thousand drop in bandwidth and embarked on an investigation of why things had gotten so bad. Meanwhile, they heard murmurings from other networking groups across the country who were running into the same thing. Jacobsen began looking into the underlying code. "Is there some mistake in the protocol?" he wondered. This thing was working on smaller-scale tests, and then it suddenly fell apart. One of the biggest differences between circuit switching and packet switching emerges in how they deal with congestion. In circuit switching, the system either approves the channel request or denies it outright if the request cannot be accommodated. That's why if you've ever tried using a phone system during some peak time, you may have encountered the special information tone and message proclaiming that all circuits are busy. Packet switching is radically different. The phone system gets full. The mail system gets slow. There's nothing in the network to explicitly tell a sender how many other senders there are or how congested the network is at any given moment, and the amount of congestion is constantly changing. Therefore, the sender and receiver must not only communicate, but meta-communicate. They need to figure out how fast the data should be sent. Somehow, assorted packet flows, without explicit management or coordination, must both get out of each other's way and quickly take advantage of any newly available space. The result of Jacobson and Carroll's detective work was a revised set of flow control and congestion avoidance algorithms, one of the biggest modifications to TCP in 40 years. At the heart of TCP congestion control is an algorithm called additive increase multiplicative decrease, or AIMD. Before AIMD kicks in, a new connection will ramp up its transmission rate aggressively. If the first packet is received successfully, it sends out two more. If both of those get through, it sends out a batch of four, and so on. But as soon as any packet's ACK does not come back to the sender, the AIMD algorithm takes over. Under AIMD, any fully received batch of packets causes the number of packets in flight not to double, but merely to increase by one. And dropped packets cause the transmission rate to cut back by half, hence the name additive increase multiplicative decrease. Essentially, AIMD takes the form of someone saying, "A little more, a little more, a little more, whoa, too much, cut way back. Okay, a little more, a little more." Thus, it leads to a characteristic bandwidth shape known as the TCP sawtooth, steady upward climbs punctuated by steep drops. Why such a sharp asymmetrical decrease? As Jacobson and Carrolls explain, the first time AIMD kicks in is when a connection has experienced the first dropped packet in its initial aggressive ramping up phase. Because that initial phase involved doubling the rate of transmission with every successful volley, cutting the speed back by half as soon as there's been a problem is entirely appropriate. And once a transmission is in progress, if it starts to falter again, that's likely to be because some new connection is competing for the network. The most conservative assessment of that situation, namely assuming you were the only person using the network and now there's a second person taking half the resources, also leads to cutting back by half. Conservatism here is essential. A network can stabilize only if its users pull back at least as fast as the rate at which it's being overloaded. For the same reason, a merely additive increase helps stabilize things for everyone, preventing rapid overload and recovery cycles. Though such a strict distinction between addition and multiplication is the kind of thing unlikely to be found in nature, the TCP sawtooth does find resonance in various domains where the idea is to take as much as one can safely get away with. In a serendipitous 2012 collaboration, for instance, Stanford ecologist Deborah Gordon and computer scientist Balaji Prabhakar discovered that ants appear to have developed flow control algorithms millions of years before humans did. Like a computer network, an ant colony faces an allocation problem in trying to manage its flow, in this case, the flow of ants heading out to forage for food, under variable conditions that may sharply affect the rate at which the ants make successful round trips. And like computers on the internet, ants must solve this shared problem without the benefit of a central decision maker, instead developing what Gordon calls control without hierarchy. It turns out the ants' solution is similar too. A feedback cycle where successful foragers prompt more to leave the nest, while unsuccessful returnees result in a diminishment of foraging activity. Other animal behavior